I think it was resonating with customers too, for a company that was a really a kind of a conglomerate of over 100 businesses. I think the clarity that we provided to customers in that effort really was helpful. Like people kind of got what we were about, right? Like, oh, okay, like these people make tests that work quickly at the point of care and that I can use to treat patients more effectively.
Welcome to Pioneering Perspectives, a DIA Creative podcast, where we explore marketing insights from regulated industries. Join me as we chat with real professionals navigating these complexities today, uncovering their stories and their savvy strategies for marketing success. Hi, everyone. We're back for another episode, and I am so excited to be here with Dave Kang, a brand strategist and founder of New Orbit Marketing. And as a reminder, I'm your host, Andrea Borcha, the founder and CMO of the digital marketing agency, DIA Creative. Dave, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Well, first and foremost, let's start a bit with how you got to where you are today.
Sure. I worked in marketing for pretty much my entire career. I have a degree in marketing from the University of Illinois. From there, I worked at a graphic design agency, joined a couple startups in e-commerce. I lived in Silicon Valley for a while and worked at a medical device startup there. That was my entrance into the marketing, into the medical field. Through a series of acquisitions, I ended up at a Fortune 100 corporation called Abbott. It was kind of a big player in the healthcare space, and left Abbott last year, started a brand consultancy this year. And that brings us to today. So that's a 1 minute history on me.
That's perfect. So, I mean, it seems like so much of your career has been focused on brand, and branding in specifically a highly regulated field can be a little tricky and nuanced because you can't just do anything you want to do. What have you found throughout your history as branding, like what the importance of brand and how to really define brand?
Yeah, I mean, healthcare is regulated. The FDA in the US and then other regulatory bodies in other countries definitely monitor what you do as in terms of marketing your products. And so you do have to be sort of careful about what you say. And branding in particular in this space, I think matters a lot because you're trying to build trust in your products that may save patients' lives. You know, they're doing really important work. And in particular, my area was diagnostics. And these products are trusted by healthcare professionals to give a correct diagnosis, et cetera. So the trust factor is a big part of branding, maybe even more so than just, you know, does it cosmetically look interesting or fun or things like that. You have to build a trustworthy look and feel to your brand in this space, I think more so than maybe other spaces.
So following down that path, what are the components that you think you really need to define when you are defining a brand in this diagnostic space?
Yeah, well, from a strategic perspective, I mean, there's a couple components of a brand. I mean, one is what category do you want to play in? Another is how do you position against competition? A third is how do you want to talk about yourself? Do you want to take like more of a scientific approach or a clinical approach versus, say, a patient-friendly approach? And then, of course, there's the entire visual component of branding that most people think of when you say brand, you know, the logo, the corporate identity, your fonts and logo, your color choices, et cetera. So all those things work together. I mean, I see brand as a very comprehensive aspect of marketing. It's not just a logo and it's not just the look and feel, but it's everything that a potential customer might experience about you. So, you know, some thought has to be put into each of those elements to make a really strong brand.
When you're specifically working on some of these past branding projects, who would you say is the target audience that you had to define? Because obviously in a lot of these more complex health situations, the person using your product that might care more about brand is not always the person choosing to pay for the product. So like, who do you actually talk to?
Yeah, this is another complication of healthcare. In many industries, you know, you target a particular customer and that person makes the decision, or that group of people makes the decision, they pay for and buy the product, and then they use it themselves. But in healthcare, there's a few players involved, depending what country you're in. But, you know, obviously physicians and laboratorians use the actual test, but there may be a purchasing department that has to weigh in. There may be some kind of clinical department that has to weigh in. And patients are obviously involved, but they're not a decision maker in this situation. You know, when patients go to a hospital, they don't even often see a laboratory test. You know, the doctor might just take their blood or urine sample and then send it to a lab, and the patient doesn't even see it or know what it is. So patients are in the picture, but they're not a decision maker, and they obviously don't buy them, at least directly from us. I mean, they may pay for the procedure through health insurance or through, you know, a pay, out-of-pocket payment. But so yeah, the people that actually purchase the product might be different than the people that use it. And that might be different from the people that benefit from it. And in other countries, there could be a global funding organization involved who's also procuring tests on behalf of a country or a health system or a ministry of health. So it's quite a complicated sales process. And the brand has to sort of speak to all of those audiences, right? Maybe less so patients because they don't see it, unless it's a self-test, you know, a home test for consumers. But for the most part, you need a brand that sort of speaks to all those audiences.
When you're defining the brand, especially because you've worked both for smaller companies, startups, all the way up to, you know, Abbott, which is massive, how important have you found that brand look and feel is, so that it is identifiable when it's sitting on a countertop, for example, amongst a bunch of other diagnostic machines?
Yeah. At the startup level, I would say it's a little bit less important in the sense that no one knows who you are, right? They're more interested in what you've built and what your product is and what it does. And like any startup, you may not have budget to create an incredible full-blown brand like you would at a large corporation. But it's still important because people still, you know, like I was saying before, people still need to trust you. They need to come to your website or be exposed to you at a trade show and still feel like, okay, this company has their act together. They seem to know what they're doing. They're building a quality product that I can trust. So it is important at every level. But it is interesting to see, you know, I worked at a startup that I joined when there were 20 something people in it, I think. And then that company was acquired by a Fortune 1000 corporation, and then that company was acquired by a Fortune 100 corporation. And at each level, the branding got more and more sophisticated, I'd say. You know, the document that I had at the startup to kind of talk about our brand was, you know, one PowerPoint document that identified the guidelines and stuff like that. But at Abbott, we had like multitudes of documents that described our brand. How do we talk about ourselves? What kind of language do we want to use? What tone of voice do we want to use? What kind of photography do we want to use? So while branding is important at every level, I think as you increase in company size and market space, you do have to like take more into consideration and build out your brand identity system to cover more touch points.
Throughout all of these different brand transitions and rebrands that you've done so many in your career, is there anyone that really stands out as one that like holds really true to your heart or was really exciting or creative to do that you loved?
Yeah, I've had some interesting opportunities in branding. Alere, which is the Fortune 1000 corporation, grew by acquiring over 100 different businesses. And the startup that I was at was one of the businesses that was acquired. Following the acquisition, because I had experience in branding and design stuff, I joined the team that helped a lot of the other acquisitions rebrand. So I saw this from many perspectives. I probably rebranded over 30 companies just in that era alone. But the one that was sort of most interesting to me was when Abbott acquired Alere to move from Fortune 1000 level up to Fortune 100 level. And just to see the sophistication that was happening at the Fortune 100 level was terrific. You know, I had been exposed to things like this in my design work at the agency that I worked at, but not had the privilege of actually like helping rebrand something at that level. You know, we were 30 some offices in countries all over the world, close to 100,000 employees, I think it was around that time. And so it was a huge endeavor to rebrand the company. And so the big thing that I kind of took away from that is that it's really important to do it carefully and do it in an organized way. And Abbott, I think, did a terrific job at this. But it was also interesting, you know, one of the things that sort of came out of that experience and also some of the Alere rebrands before that was that customers don't see it as disruptive as you might when you're the company doing it. You know, as you prepare for a rebrand, you might think, oh no, it's going to be so disruptive. People will be confused. We'll lose all our equity in the previous brand and stuff like that. But what I discovered is that customers move on pretty quickly. You know, they say, okay, well, thanks for letting me know. I'll just switch the name on my purchasing, you know, computer system, or I'll just watch for your new box. I mean, we did a great job communicating all this, but I feel like they weren't as disrupted as we may have felt like they might be. I think part of the reason is because there's so much M&A, merger and acquisition activity in the healthcare space, especially in this area. And so I get the feeling some customers were kind of, okay, I've seen this before, you know, just tell me what the new name is, and they don't care as much. But so that was an interesting learning in that experience.
Yeah, I could see that, like, especially internally, like when, especially you're in the marketing department, you are in charge of brand. Like, it feels like, oh my gosh, I'm changing everything that I spend my every day doing. But, you know, for the customers, you're just one more thing on the shelf, one more thing in their process. So
yeah,
I could see that. That's really
yeah.
funny.
If you go into the warehouse at some of these, I don't know if they call it a warehouse, but you know, like the storeroom or whatever, stock room for a lot of these laboratory companies, they have products from hundreds of companies, you know, everything from tongue depressors to Q-tips and table paper. And then there's your stuff too. So that it can be kind of overwhelming for the customers to see. And it's good to remember that, because you kind of get this sense of self-importance, like, oh, my brand's going to stand out.
Yeah.
But then you go into these stock rooms and you're just like one of 100 products. So it's just something to keep in mind. Just keep putting yourself in your customer's shoes, I think, is a good exercise.
Yeah, I love that. So one other thing, especially with, you know, Fortune 1000, Fortune 100 companies, you are spreading this brand across the entire globe, across different cultures, across different priorities. How did you manage to keep it feeling consistent, but still respect the local areas of these different countries?
Yeah, I mean, this is a challenge for any global corporation. To A, establish a brand that works globally, and B, implement it across countries and across cultures. I mean, obviously, certain things like just the logo symbol itself might be easier to do than the language part of it, in terms of how you talk about yourself. But, you know, we did a lot of testing in market. You know, the global team obviously sets the stage for the brand, but we got a lot of feedback from our own employees that worked in these different countries, but then also got, in some cases, got the aid of some outside market research companies, brand research companies, to just gut check things, especially when, for example, you're naming a product. You know, everybody likes to quote the famous Nova car, or maybe I'm dating myself with this, but you know, there was a car company that wanted to create a car, and they named it Nova. I think it was back in the 80s, but in Spanish, like Nova means like no go. So you know, it kind of backfired on them, and there's other examples of this. So you definitely, with language, you definitely have to check, ideally in country with a native speaker, does this word mean, have like a double meaning or a slang meaning or some other meaning that we're not considering, because you don't want to launch something and then have people be offended or turned off by your product because it's named in some funny way. So we definitely did a lot of, like, on the ground in the field feedback gathering, just to make sure we weren't stepping on anyone's toes.
Now, taking to the other side of the spectrum for your process as a brand strategist, so global conglomerate, you have to consider all this, but let's say we're a brand new medical device startup and we have this great technology we love, but now it comes to the marketing side, which I think happens a lot. There's a lot of startups out there that are built by scientists and engineers, and then all of a sudden they're like, okay, now it's time to sell it. Now what? So how would you come in and help, and what is your process to get them to a healthy place?
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of times startups just want a logo, right? They kind of start with that, like, yeah, I need a logo to put on my box or on my website or things like that. And obviously it's a core component of your brand identity. But before I even get to design, I would ask them, what is your 5-10 year strategy for the company? What's your long-term view on where you're headed? Because ideally, you create an identity or a branding system and strategy that lasts for a decade, right? You don't want to have to come back 2 years later and redo this all over again. So with the information you do have, as best you can, knowing as what you do know at the moment about your customers, I try to get a lay of the land and do some preliminary stuff before we even touch an Adobe Creative product to start designing something. So, and I touched on a couple of these, but one is like the company strategy, the other is the product strategy. Is it going to be just a one horse institution, or do you plan to make a portfolio of products? Because then you have to like think about how you're going to name this suite of things. Like one mistake I often see startups making is that they name the product the same name as the company. And that's fine if you have one product and you're just starting out, like, and you're trying to build a name for yourself. But as soon as you introduce a second product or even like an update to that first product, you're going to face a conundrum. Like, what do you call it? Like, you can't call it the company name 2.0 or something. Like, you have to think of a new name, especially if you add to the line, product line down the road. So, that's something to just really think about is like you want to separate your company name from your brand name. So that's just an example before we even get to design. So then the other things are positioning, who's already in the market that you'll be competing against? How can you differentiate against them? What category are you going to play in? Is it a physician-focused category or a patient-focused category? How do you want to talk about what you're doing? Is it a focus on the disease? Is it a focus on the technology platform that you have? Or is it focused on the pain points that you're trying to address? So depending on what you're building and what you're trying to sell, you may take a different strategy. So it kind of varies, but I do encourage people to kind of think through category design and positioning in particular. I feel like are two super important things to understand. And if you're a scientist and clinician or a person who has like high technical ability but doesn't know marketing, I mean, I would really at least just try to get a basic understanding of what positioning and category are. There's plenty of blogs and videos about this. You could just spend 10, 15 minutes, just familiarize yourself with the concept, even if you can't execute it yourself and you still want to hire someone to help. It just really helps to understand what those two things are. And then I'll set you up for like knowing how to design your brand.
Leaning into that a little bit more, are you finding that when you do have to define brand or redefine brand, looking at the marketplace, that that almost defines if it's category or like if it's technology? Because I feel like a lot of the startups are like, oh, we're better or we're faster or we're cheaper, and you're like, okay, but that's not anything that's stands out in any way.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, do you look at the competitors and be like, oh, well, these three are all saying they're better, so we're going to say we're faster, or we're going to focus more on the problem solution, or we're going to focus more on our story, or whatever it is? Or do you feel like it really does have to come from internal, from the brand, without considering the marketplace as much?
Yeah. I think it's a little bit of both, right? Like one is what are you capable of building? And with the technical prowess you have on your R&D team and whatever it is you're making, ideally you make a product that is already differentiated, without even talking about it as a marketer. Like if the product itself has some strong innovation and differentiating features, it makes the marketing so much easier, right? So if you make a me too product and you enter a crowded field, you're going to struggle with the marketing part of it. Some people say like to have great marketing, like it starts with a great product. The better and more interesting, more innovative your product can be, the easier the marketing becomes. And I totally believe that, because if it's the same, then you're going to be kind of like scrounging for scraps and trying to figure out like splitting hairs over minor differences in your product versus a competitor. But if you, from the get-go, build something that is truly new and truly stands out, then it makes the marketing easier. So at the product level, ideally you're starting with something awesome. But moving to the marketing activity, definitely you have to think about your competition, because if you create marketing that you think is great, and then you may go out and realize that, well, like, oh, there's this competitor that's saying literally the exact same thing. They are you are not differentiated at all. And then what happens is you might end up in a pricing war and a race to the bottom, which will erode your margins. And then you will, you know, struggle in for the viability of your business. So I do think it's important to think about competitors, but it's more important to think about like yourself in terms of like, how are you going to stand out in this field? How are you going to approach the market? How are you going to talk about yourself in ways that makes your customers say, oh, wait, this is something different. You know, I haven't seen this before, or I haven't heard about this kind of category of product talked about before. And you want to, you know, work on your messaging and brand to help do that. But I do think the category position, category design is really important. Like who are you, which market are you really entering? And who's there right now? The ideal situation, you know, if you read books like The Blue Ocean Strategy or whatever, the ideal situation is you have no competition, or you swim in a zone where there's either no competition at all or very little competition. And marketing can kind of craft that narrative, even if there's always competition, right? Like there's always some alternative to whatever you're building. So I don't think you, like hardly anyone can say there's no competition for what I've built. I know some young founders often like to say that only because like no one has built it the exact same way, but there are alternatives to the thing that you've built. So in a sense, those are competitive alternatives, right? Like what would you use if your product didn't exist? And people have answers to that question. So I do think it's important to think about that, but ideally both the product and the marketing are such that you really stand out on your own in a different space than a competitive space. So you don't play head to head wars and get into price battles and stuff.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great example. The one story in Blue Ocean Strategy that always stands out for me is Cirque du Soleil, which differentiated itself because it's not a circus and it's not really like a Broadway play or an acrobatic show. It's a little bit of everything. But you're right, because if I'm in Vegas, I could go to Cirque, I could go to a different kind of show, I could go to dinner, I could go dancing. So it's like all of those actually do become alternatives if I only have $150 spent tonight.
Exactly.
So similarly in the rest of it. So I would think this would be a problem both for the small businesses you've worked with and the large conglomerates, is once you have the brand defined, startups move so fast, they could erode it. And massive companies have so many people that touch the brand, that is there a way to properly, like, how we've defined brand, we're ready to go. How do you make sure that all that work you did continues to benefit forward 1, 5, 10 years in the future?
And it is interesting, the difference in how you make decisions at a startup versus at a large corporation, whether it's brand or anything really. You know, at the startup, there was pretty much one other person, my direct supervisor, that I had to ask like if I could do something, and he would kind of give a green light or not. But at the large corporation, there's at least 7 people, you know, and in some cases many more, that go both sideways and up the ladder, who have to like chime in on stuff, and rightfully so, because they're, you know, the higher ups are setting the direction for the company, and they want to make sure whatever you're doing aligns to that strategy. So it makes sense. It does slow things down though, right? So you have to talk to more people. You got to work your sort of gain buy-in hat and talk to people in the right way, be able to convince people on the inside that they should take a certain course of action, et cetera. So like influencing from your role, wherever you sit in the organization, is important. But more directly to your question, I mean, it's the same at the startup level and at Fortune 100 level, where if you want to think 1, 5, 10 years down the road, and how are you going to implement that? How are you going to make it stick? How are you going to get employees to buy into it? I do think having a long-term view is important for brand strategy, but you also have to be willing to be a little bit flexible and iterate on it, right? Like that, like you'll notice that companies often will make even minor tweaks to their logo over time. Like in fact, oh, well, this typography doesn't read as well, so they clean it up to make it slightly more legible. I mean, that's like a very simple, basic example. And sometimes companies do this and you don't even know. They just make some minor adjustments on the inside and they don't make a big deal out of it, but somehow the logo or the brand system is changed in some way or another. So it is important to kind of like think about it as long-termist a view as you can. But in terms of like rolling it out and getting people to like use it in both in the near term and long, I mean, ideally you have to convey to your employees what the new brand is about, or what either why you created a new brand or why you're rebranding an old brand, because there can be some resistance there, right? Like there can be some employees who fall in love with your previous brand, and when you show them the new strategy, they hate it, or they just think the other one was better. And so there is a little bit of like convincing and influencing that you have to do at the employee level. But then as you roll things out, I think the touch points across the portfolio are really important. I mean, the big word that, you know, I try to use in terms of implementation is consistency, that you just want customers to have a consistent experience of your brand, no matter what touch point they encounter. So if they go to your website, it's a certain brand experience. If they go to see your booth at a congress or a trade show, that's a brand experience. If a salesperson comes in and hands you a brochure, that's a brand experience. If they send you an email, like what's in the email signature is a brand experience, right? So there's all these different ways to express a brand in the marketplace. And it's your job as a brand person to kind of control that and police it to some degree, because you'll always have employees who want to do their own thing. You know, they want to throw in some fun photo into their email signature, or, you know, they just don't like the brand. Or in the case of a larger corporation, they may have their own design agency in their country that they work with. And you have to now teach that design agency, okay, here's what our brand looks like. Here's how we talk about ourselves. Here's how we're positioning the company. And here are some off limits things that you should never say about us and things like that. So there's some training that needs to happen at the employee level. And then further out, even down to the country and sometimes to external vendors too, you have to train them on your brand and provide brand guideline documents so they know what to do with your brand if it's their job to implement it in some way.
That buy-in is super important at that point, because you're right. I've definitely seen that resistance where they're like, no, I love this brand. Why are we changing it? Why are we going in with a new color? Why are we doing this? So getting that buy-in and almost kind of doing like an internal roadshow to get that buy-in seems like, oh, like a recommended part of branding in any way, right?
Yeah, definitely. I think a roadshow is a great way to characterize it. You know, like the worst thing that you could do if you're a founder at a smaller, medium-sized company is to work with your VP of marketing and maybe go hire a brand agency, get the brand redone, and start to implement it and just like tell everyone, here's our new brand. You know, like it helps to sort of warm the fire a little bit. Like you could tell people in advance, look, we're thinking about rebranding the company. Do you have any inputs on this? You know, what do you think we should improve? Like what's not working for you about our brand right now, right? Like you can involve people in the process without freaking them out and just say like, look, maybe it's even before you've made the decision, you could say like, we're just thinking about this. You know, is it something that you think is worth doing? Would it help you in your efforts if you're a salesperson in particular? You know, are there things that are inconsistent about our brand, or have customers like complained about something or expressed confusion about something that we're trying to convey? And you can kind of bring them along in the process. I mean, now obviously you don't want the process to get bogged down by having 100 cooks in the kitchen, but you could selectively pick maybe one person from each region to kind of act as a regional representative. Or if you don't have that many regions, like just one person from each department, and just at least let them know what you're doing and bring them along in the process. So then it's not like buy-in doesn't have to be a massive surprise, right? Where it's like, okay, surprise, like we have a new brand strategy, and people will be hesitant or resistant to something like that. But if they know it's coming, and then you roll it out in a roadshow and give rationale why, like, why did we change X, Y, and Z? Like, what was weak about what we were doing before? And how is this new thing going to help you do your job better? I think that goes a long way to getting internal buy-in.
I think that's such a great point you bring up, because I feel like most people, especially not in marketing, actually probably some people in channel marketing, but like definitely people outside of marketing don't realize how much time and effort goes into brand. I mean, I'm sure you've spent at time like 6 to 12 months really building out a brand. And some people are like, oh, you know, we decided overnight and it took a week of developing a logo and here's a brand book and you're good to go. So involving people earlier, I think makes a lot of sense. Specifically with your marketing career, because you've touched on a bunch of things, is there a reason you went into brand versus other channels? Is there something special about brand that really speaks to you?
Yeah, well, I've always been a creative person, even since I was a kid. You know, I was making art projects and doing more creative things. And so at that time, you know, I didn't even know what a brand was. But like after I graduated from college, I worked at a graphic design agency for a while. I just really loved that. I loved the design element of brand and the appearance part of it. I didn't know a lot about branding at that time. I was young in my 20s, but there was something about the visual component that I think introduced me to the idea of a brand that just really appealed to me. So as someone who cares about aesthetics and, you know, thinks about design and does design thinking kind of thing, it just really appealed to me, say more than like doing SEO or, you know, something more tactical like that. So I think, yeah, from the get-go, I was kind of interested in the visual part of branding. I designed some logos and corporate identities at that first design job. And of all the projects that came in the door, I liked doing those the most. I found them the most challenging, but I also just liked the simplicity of compressing like a company's ethos all the way down to some small symbol and turning it into a logo. It was just a really fun process for me. So I think from the get-go, yeah, I was interested. But as my career progressed, my thinking on it became more sophisticated. You know, I worked on more complicated projects, started in the US and then expanded globally. So the international component added more complexity to the mix. But even through all of that, I just still liked brand. I don't have a great explanation why, but you know, their marketing is a huge bucket, right? There's so many different ways you can do marketing nowadays. There, you know, there's like 30 different job titles just for a marketer today. And so of all the things that a marketer could do, I just really like branding the most. So that's what I've focused most of my career on. Although I've done a little bit of everything, you know, like at a startup, you have to just do everything. But as I grew in my career, I could like be a little bit more selective on things I chose to focus on or volunteered for. Yeah, for anyone who's listening that is employed and, you know, is thinking about a career in brand, you know, I do think you can ask, right? Like you can volunteer. I asked to be on a couple teams, you know, when I knew a new product was coming out, I asked to join a rebrand project. You know, I wanted to sit in on the meetings with the agency that was doing work and stuff like that. So, you kind of have to push to move in the direction that you want to go.
Yeah, I love that advice. That's great. With brand specifically, when you're talking about like distilling things down to a visual experience, is there any project that you've really felt like when you finished out the brand that it was evoking the emotions or the connection that you were expecting from the experience that you wanted the customers to get?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Alier, so just a little history. Alier, the company used to be called Inverness Medical. And while I was there, Inverness Medical rebranded itself completely to Alier, like all the acquisitions it made, well, not all of them, but most of them, you know, we rebranded pretty much the entire company to Alier. And I really liked how that landed, because we also, at the same time, you know, came up with this tagline called "Knowing Now Matters," which speaks to like the speed of a diagnostic test. A lot of our products worked in like 15 minutes or less, and so the speed of getting a diagnostic answer was really important for customers. And so I really liked that pairing, like the rebranding and then the company tagline of "Knowing Now Matters," really. And I was glad to kind of like be a coordinative part of that project to come up with the tagline. I didn't invent it myself. I feel like I invented like one word in it, but other people chimed in, and you know, it was kind of a team effort, like a lot of inputs from many people. But I do like where that landed, and I was kind of sad to see it disappear, you know, after the Abbott acquisition. Abbott has its own tagline and stuff, so you know, it doesn't make sense to have two. So I understand why they dropped it, but you know, I really like how that one turned out. I think it was resonating with customers too. You know, for a company that was really a kind of a conglomerate of over 100 businesses, I think the clarity that we provided to customers in that effort really was helpful. Like people kind of got what we were about, right? Like, oh, okay, like these people make tests that work quickly at the point of care and that I can use to treat patients more effectively. I think people recognize the helpful tool that product line was.
That's a really powerful example of how a three-word tagline actually means a 20-word statement. Exactly as you were laying it out. Like, I love that. I feel like that really exemplifies the power of a good brand and why you should spend time and effort on it. So now that we're going into the future, what do you think is important to consider with brand, or where do you see branding going as we continue to bring in new technology? Like, obviously, AI is now part of the componentry, and the medical field is changing. There's new regulations. There's trying to do a lot more transparency with everything across different fields in medical and diagnostics and et cetera. So where do you kind of see the future heading?
I think the trust component that we were talking about earlier is always going to be there. Like, no matter what technology or tools we use to create brands, particularly in healthcare, it might be slightly different in other industries, but particularly in healthcare, the trust component will always be there. Like, you have to have a trustworthy brand. People have to like respect it. People have to know that it stands for something good. But how brands are developed is definitely changing. I mean, so now you can ask AI to make you a logo. So it's kind of starting to bite off designer jobs to some degree. And I did see a company recently that was using AI to give you an entire positioning strategy. Like, you would input your competitors and then talk about your products and what you wanted to accomplish and things like that. And so there are a lot, bunch of inputs, and then it would spit out a brand strategy for you. Now, I'm a little bit skeptical of this.
Yeah.
Like, at least right now, I'm like, what kind of results are you going to get from that, really? Because as you know, like, AI is just aggregating things that are already in the public internet or things that have been it has been fed. And so that means it's by nature been fed things that already exist, like not new ideas, right? And I think that's one of the limitations right now. I do think it will eventually get to the point where it's generating ideas and coming up with something new. But right now, it just seems to be kind of like, dealing with existing ideas and regurgitating them, maybe reformatting them in a cleaner way, and then spitting them back out to you. And so, like, in the current environment, I don't see these tools as particularly helpful if you're serious about it, right? Like, if you're really just starting out and you're on a shoestring budget and you need a logo and you don't want to spend $5, $10, $50,000 to have an agency do it right, like, sure, like, knock yourself out, use an online logo generator, get your $10 logo, and just to get started, right? And I don't have any qualms with that, but like, you're not going to get something good. Like, I've tinkered with some of these tools and they're not, it's just not there yet. It is just kind of like recombining stuff you've already seen. So what the outputs are typically really quite generic. But I do think like AI is absolutely a tool that's chomping at the bit of the marketing and branding arena, right? And I think it'll only get better at those things. And so as a human person that works in marketing, it's something I've had to think about. Like, if I envision, like, say, 15 years out, like, what's my job going to be as a brand marketer? And I do think a lot of people will be using AI tools to support their brand efforts. You can ask questions like, who are all the competitors in this particular market sector, right? Like, it'll help you with market research. It'll absolutely help you with competitive research. It'll help you with market sizing. It'll help you even like research for healthcare people listening. It'll help you with diseases, prevalence, trending. Like, is the number of patients who are contracting a disease going up or down? It'll help you identify markets that you might potentially want to target. So AI will absolutely be like a research arm in helping you like round out your knowledge about something quickly. But I do think the two parts that I'm still not convinced AI will do better than a human are infusing logos with concepts like trust. Like, if you tell AI, like, make me a trustworthy logo or a logo that customers will find trustworthy, I don't know that it'll spit out anything really good. But so like the human component that can't be done, I feel like will still always be there, right? The emotional component. I mean, the AI is a computer, so it thinks like a computer, talks like a computer, acts like a computer, but people buy from people. They like to know that there's humans behind a corporation, even if it's a large corporation. And so the more human you can make things, the better. I guess that's the other point I'd like to point out is that, like, the human component, I think, is going to become more important. Like, personalized selling, more CEOs will have blogs and post on LinkedIn than do now. People will want to know who are the faces behind these corporations. I think corporations will loosen up on their social media policies to let employees speak more as almost like internal influencers on behalf of their corporation. And they will be brand representatives, right? They'll be a component of the brand experience is employees talking about the company. So there'll have to be some controls around that. But I do think this idea of like personalizing the corporation is going to continue. And people wanting to deal with people and not computers is going to continue as well.
I would definitely agree with that. We've been playing with AI a little bit on our side too, and I haven't really been happy with the level of copy. But we just recently had to do a name. We were hired to name their newest product, and okay. AI came out with 20 options that sounded so generic and so like this is not going to stand out at all. But on our side, we got together as a group and we actually started to think through not just the name, but how does it iterate into the different ways you speak in marketing and all the different visuals we could do. So we actually thought about it from a larger system of marketing almost. And I feel like I agree with you. AI can't really do that. It can see what exists and give you that, but ideating something new and thinking about the future implications, it's not quite there yet.
Yeah. It's a brainstorming partner for
yes.
sure, you know,
yeah.
right? So if you're not a super creative person or you just want some fresh ideas that are out of the box, you could ask AI, you know, give me a list of names. Here's a product I'm trying to make. Give me a list of potential brand names for it and just see what comes back. I mean, it's the same way that before AI, when I had naming projects, I used an online thesaurus, right? Like you go to the thesaurus, give me another word for speed or something like that. And it would just give you a bunch of words, right? And it just helps you like round out your thinking and maybe come up with word combinations that you might have not have thought of before. And so I see AI absolutely performing the same function and maybe even better, right? Like if you say, give me synonyms for speed, it'll do that better and maybe even faster than a thesaurus, like looking through like the dictionary entries and stuff like that. But I absolutely think as a brainstorming partner, it'll be in heavy use.
Yeah, I do like the brainstorming. And you were mentioning the research thing. The only thing that always makes me nervous about research is all these studies about AI making stuff up. You're like, give me three technical resources and like these authors don't exist. And they're like, here's three papers. And you're like, okay, no, that doesn't,
right.
Those aren't real. So don't do that. If you're working in the medical space, do not trust AI to give you your sources. I think that's the message.
Like it doesn't know if it's asking you to make something up, like make up a study,
yeah.
or it's asking you to find an existing one. I guess you have to be clear about that because it could just write one for you.
And that ends up becoming dangerous. A marketing skill is how to get AI to do what you want it to do.
Yeah, that's definitely like I think, you know, prompting, which is what it is right now. I don't know what form prompting will take in the future, but it's absolutely a skill that people, not just marketers, but like anyone needs, any knowledge worker needs to start getting good at, just understanding how these AI tools think so you can talk to them in a way that gets you the results that you want. And I'm trying to do this too. Like, I don't understand it completely. You know, it's still kind of experimental for me, but you know, I have seen that like, depending how you ask it, it can produce vastly different results, right? So it is a skill to know like what to input to get the outputs that you're looking for.
Absolutely. Well, awesome. This has been such a fun conversation, Dave. And we don't usually get to dig into brand specifically this much. So I want to thank Dave Kang for joining us on today's episode. Where can they learn more about you?
Yeah, my brand website is neworbitmarketing.com. And I'm on LinkedIn as Dave Kang. I think I was early enough to like the URL actually says Dave Kang when I beat out the other Dave Kang. I don't know. Maybe there's not that many Dave Kangs in the world, but like, you know how it's hard to get your actual name sometimes on these platforms, but I'm on LinkedIn as Dave Kang. And then neworbitmarketing.com is my marketing website. And thanks for having me. It's been really fun to catch up and talk about branding with you. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Anytime. And as you continue on with more branding projects, maybe we can touch base again and like see how they're all going. So perfect.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, Dave.
Great. Thanks, Andrea. Cheers.
I really enjoyed this conversation with Dave Kang. Brand is one of those things we don't really focus on as much as we should, especially in the medical marketing space. But it's just one of those key foundational components that's so important for setting yourself up for success. As we're all learning and growing, and the marketing world is ever evolving, I like to end each episode with a couple key takeaways. One, the importance of trust in healthcare branding. In any regulated industry, but especially in healthcare, that is such a personal industry, building trust is paramount. Brands must convey authenticity, reliability, and expertise to establish credibility with their patients, healthcare professionals, and other stakeholders. I feel like Dave really explained how even the nuance of a logo or a color can convey trust and build that emotional connection to a brand. Two, how complex healthcare branding really is. Unlike your typical brand, if you're B2C or B2B, you're really just thinking about typically one end consumer group. But in healthcare branding, it's rare you're only talking to one particular target market. You're actually targeting multiple audiences, from patients to physicians to purchasing departments. Each one presents a unique challenge, and speaking to them all with the same branding to really set yourself up for success as a healthcare brand, you need to resonate with each of these groups, patients, payers, providers, while maintaining consistency and clarity. And finally, three, the need for long-term brand strategy and universal brand strategy. Thinking through how the brand is going to be interacted with in multiple spaces, digital, video, in person, on a large screen at a conference, on a tiny little pipette that might be part of your medical device. Thinking through how your brand exists in all of these different planes and how each individual is going to interact with it is super critical. On top of this, consider the breadth of your brand and how far it could really go. When Dave brought up the example about Nova and how globally it wasn't exactly the best name for a car, it really had me thinking through every brand that I interact with today and whether or not it can have universal appeal globally. In healthcare marketing, have you found it's challenging to balance the emotional connection you need to make versus getting the information across that's the most important? As you explore your own marketing projects in healthcare, have you find it a bit challenging to lean into the emotional versus the actual technical results? If that's you, definitely check out our next episode where I talk to Sherry Lynn. We dive into the emotional resonance of marketing campaigns and the significance of building connections with everyday moments. Well, that's the end of our episode for today. If you work in a regulated field like medical, legal, or finance and want to share your own marketing insights, email us at podcast@diacreative.com. And if you're looking for marketing support, well, that's exactly what we do. Visit diacreative.com, diacreative.com. Any other info you might need will be in the show notes, including all links mentioned in this episode. Thanks for listening.